on the road or off-road, Chevy Silverado is built for tough performance in any condition. Hit the road in a new Silverado pickup. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for a dealer near you. Chevy Silverado, official truck partner of the Chicago Bears.
All right. What do you say we do a little podcast here, my friend, huh? Good. You all set? Trigger finger? Ready to go? All right, Reg, I'll give you the three S's. Star, smile, strong. And here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And of course, it's important to listen, but I think it's just as important to get out there and tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Of course, if you like what you've been listening to, either it's for a couple of months, a couple of weeks, or even for almost a decade, since we've been doing this for almost 10 years now, whatever your situation is, if you want to hear some past podcasts, you can always go to WGNRadio.com, go to the podcast section, and hit the prompt for this podcast. And there you will find a plethora of podcasts just waiting for your perusal and enjoyment from the last couple of weeks or even the last couple of years. It goes back pretty far. Not all 10 years are available, but a good sampling that goes pretty far back. And as I always try to say, it's always good to listen to some of the old podcasts because it gives you an idea as to what we've been talking about before and what we might be talking about in the future. And speaking of the future is now. And right now is podcast 509. So, interesting things going on, discussions going on concerning the Football Hall of Fame. And I'm not going to be just talking about sports here. I really think that this whole idea of a Hall of Fame, while at one time I think a very noble and interesting and prestigious title, and something that I think captured the imagination of any kind of fan, whether it was sports, whether it is the arts, whether, there's a Hall of Fame for almost anything now, which is part of the problem, I think. We are certainly in an era now, and it's been going on for quite a while, where everybody needs attention, everybody needs accolades, everybody needs a title, everybody needs, let's just leave it that way, everybody needs. I would say probably 30 some years now, we've been in this world of everybody gets a trophy. We have tried to eliminate competition. We've been much more cognizant of this. I have my theories as to how this all came about, but I don't want to polarize, because I'm sure that my theories on this would not be that popular. But I still think they're very valid, and I still believe them. But, like I said many times, I don't have children, so I wasn't involved in the everybody gets a trophy era that started, as I said, probably somewhere in the 90s. So I wasn't involved with that with my kids, and I certainly wasn't involved in it with me personally. When I grew up, you still got a trophy if you earned it, if you won something. When I was growing up, there was still competition, and excellence was still encouraged and awarded and prized. And today, it is and it isn't. We don't know what to do. We are in an era of nobody wants to be offended. Nobody wants to hurt anybody's feelings. Nobody wants to hurt anybody's self-esteem. And so competition obviously cuts into the face of that. We have always been a competitive species from day one. I think it's in our DNA code. We are trying to eliminate it or suppress it. I think as much as we try to suppress it, it just becomes harder to suppress it because it's impossible to do it. But we are always trying to suppress many of our natural instincts. And I always say, look to the animal kingdom. Animal kingdom does not try to suppress their instincts. They lean into them. They live with them. They live by them. They don't question them. And they've been around for a pretty long time. And they seem to have a pretty good social order. Everybody knows the rules. Everybody plays by the same rules, and the species, several species, I mean, obviously, you know, other, you know, species become extinct over time based on many different elements. But if you look at the majority of species of animals and insects and even plants, anything else except humans, there is a structure and an order. It is based on instinct. And it has remained that way, and there is not a lot of churn or tumult in the animal kingdom. There is competition. As I said, look to the animal kingdom. There is competition. We see that all the time, where a new leader of the pack or whatever group it is, you know, there has to be some kind of a physical fight or something. And there are some species that actually do reject members of a tribe or a pack or whatever the grouping is. We look at it as, you know, cruel. They don't view it that way at all. The animals, you know, but they don't have our greatest asset, and as I said many times, our greatest deficit, which is the ability to reason, our logic, our thought. We still at times do react on our instincts, on our pure animal instincts, but since, you know, centuries, millennia, if you will, we have been trying to suppress those because we would be just as wild as the animals are, and probably even worse, because we see how we act when we're let alone, and it's not a good thing. So we are always trying to weed out the negatives of what is in our DNA. But, you know, we are a part of the animal kingdom, and we possess many of those same instincts. And as I've said many times, you know, the ability to reason and think sets us apart, but also is our greatest asset amongst all the species on Earth. And at the same time, it's a huge deficiency because we get into emotions, and then we get into thinking and overthinking, and that's when the problems start. And that's what's happened, I think, with the Hall of Fames. Wow, how did I get from the DNA code of the human species to Hall of Fames? Well, they are connected. Let me explain. So as I said, over the last 30 years or so, suddenly this phenomenon of soccer moms and snacks and no competition and not keeping score, and everybody gets a trophy, seem to be a new philosophy to cut down on, you know, to help the self-esteem of children and to limit the amount of hurt. And I understand all that. But the fact of the matter is that's not the way the real world works. And we have been trying to create these little bubble worlds for children in various ways to protect them and from the realities of life. And I can understand that to a certain point, but the reality of life is that they will not be able to be protected at a certain point in their lives. And they will need to go out into that world. And it is not all peaches and cream. And there's a point when parents cannot control that world and keep harm away from them and keep bad things away from them. And the sooner that people learn how to handle disappointment, the better off they're going to be, because disappointment's going to happen to everybody. And we've seen that. Rich or poor, powerful or weak, it doesn't matter. There are some great equalizers in the world. And reality is the biggest one. And it affects everyone, regardless of your station, regardless of your status, regardless of your bank account, whatever it is. Disappointment and bad things can and often do happen to anyone. I was just looking, I was watching a couple weeks ago a special about John F. Kennedy Jr. and his wife and her sister. You know, if you remember back in 1999, the three of them died in a plane crash that John Kennedy Jr. was flying a private plane to Martha's Vineyard, and or from Martha's Vineyard, I think, to Hyannisport. And, you know, I mean, this guy was literally the king of America. You know, we're talking about right now. The funny thing is that, you know, we're hearing no kings. I'm not trying to get political here, but I'm trying to point out some hypocrisies. You know, we're hearing the term no kings right now. It's a very popular rallying cry. And once again, I'm not taking any sides here. I'm just stating the facts. We're hearing no kings, especially as we approach our 250th birthday, which is ironic since it was a king that we were revolting against. But so we hear no kings, and that's become a very popular and simple rallying cry for people that are anti-Trump, anti, you know, MAGA, whatever you want to call it. But we have to, and a lot of the people that are using that term may have been too young to realize. You know, if you were born, you know, if you're in your 20s or even mid 30s, you might not even remember John F. Kennedy Jr. being alive. He passed away 26 years ago. And so if you were born in the mid 90s, you probably maybe you've heard his name, but you don't even remember him. He's more of a myth and somebody who lives in pictures than somebody who really lived. But take it from those of us who have been around during John F. Kennedy Jr.'s life. He was, and the Kennedys, to a great extent, were the American royalty. And even though the Kennedy family has been plagued, to my point earlier about, you know, bad things can happen to whoever you are, as long as you're on this planet, you are susceptible to having disappointment and bad things happen. And my gosh, I mean, the Kennedy family is probably the greatest example of that. Here is a family filled with wealth and privilege and access and you name it. I mean, I don't know. They, you can't ask for anything more. I mean, the irony is that the Kennedy family made its money illegally for the most part through the Prohibition days of bootlegging. But we don't talk about that. But anyway, the Kennedy family, at a time, was as close to American royalty as we had. I mean, you know, we've had all these monarchs, and We still have the British family, even though that has certainly, diminished over the last 40 years or so. And certainly since Lady Di's death, we have seen the royal family really being knocked down a peg in terms of international respect that was just automatically granted to the British family and Queen Elizabeth and, at the time, Prince Charles and everybody. And now, over the last several years with tabloid journalism and things like that, the realities of that family and the hardships have been front page news. Look at Prince Andrew right now amidst all this Epstein file stuff. So even the British family, the British royal family, which in all the world is probably at one time was the most still revered and respected, and even they have been knocked down several pegs. But in the United States, the Kennedy family was about as close to American royalty as possible. And over the years, we've seen what that privilege, that access, that money has done for them. It's obviously given them very good lifestyles, but that family and the entire tree is very gnarled, and there has been some amazingly sad and even horrific tragedies that have struck that family. Even most recently, Caroline Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's daughter, her daughter was in her mid-30s and just passed away from cancer. They've had people in accidents. Obviously, John F. Kennedy assassinated. Robert F. Kennedy assassinated. They've had scandals involving deaths and money. And then, obviously, John F. Kennedy Jr. In this just tragic private plane crash that he was flying and killed him and his wife. And her sister. And my goodness, John F. Kennedy wasn't even 40. I think his wife, Carolyn, wasn't even 35. Once again, and John F. Kennedy, not only did he have movie star, dreamboat looks, from what I'm told, but there's no question that ultimately, he would have followed in his family's footsteps of politics. They were grooming him, and I have no question. I have no doubts that ultimately John F. Kennedy Jr. would have been the Democratic nominee for president. In fact, if you look at the way things went, given his age, and he needed some seasoning, I think it took him 3 times to pass the bar exam, but it doesn't matter. That name and those looks and that aura, there's no question that John F. Kennedy Jr., whether he was qualified or not, whether he should have been able to rise that high, he would have. There's no question. The gossip magazines were in love with him. The media was in love with him. I think that he would have had enough handlers around him that they would have been able to protect him enough and get him into the White House. In fact, as my point is, if you look at his age and the way things were moving, and he was so prominent, people were just waiting for him to get a little older, and then he could be considered presidential timber. It was basically, it wasn't a question with John F. Kennedy Jr. It wasn't a question of would he be president. It was just a question of when. When would be the right time? And so the way that I look at it You know, the irony is that while the Democratic Party looks at the election of Barack Obama as a high point in Democratic Party history, obviously the first African American to be to be elected president, I think that if you look at the timeline, I don't think Barack Obama would have been able. I mean, he may have become president down the line. I mean, don't forget, he was a young guy too. He may have been around the same age as John F. Kennedy Jr. Actually, I don't know what year Obama was born. I know that John Kennedy Jr. was born in 1960. Let me take a look here and see when Barack was what year he was born. Because they actually, I mean, they were very close in age. Yeah, he was born in 61. So he was actually a year younger than John F. Kennedy Jr. But if you look at the timeline, John F. Kennedy Jr. most likely would have run for president in the 2008 election. Because in 1999 he was still too young, so they would have to have done a little seasoning on him. But after 8 years of George Bush, you know, coming in 2001, I think they would have said, "Okay, John's ready." It would have been about almost 10 years. He would have been 48 or 49, and they would have said, okay, he's ready. And during the 8 years of the Bush presidency, when it was clear that a Democrat was going to win, there was so much chaos going on and so much questions about our involvement in Iraq and everything, that I think it was no question that a Democratic president was going to come in after 8 years of George Bush. So the question was, which one? And once again, if you remember, I mean, this was the election of the first, of Hillary Clinton getting in and being a legitimate candidate and viewed as the favorite. And then this no-name Barack Obama coming out of nowhere and rising in popularity and to be considered the first, an African-American to actually seriously be considered to win. You know, we just recently saw the passing of Reverend Jesse Jackson, and he was the first African American to get X amount of votes. I can't remember, he ran twice for president, and in many ways, he did. Open the path for Barack Obama. 20 years later, but my point is that John F. Kennedy most likely would have run in the 2008 election. And I don't see how Hillary or certainly an unknown, I don't even think Barack Obama would have run. Barack Obama was still young enough where he probably would have said, okay, I have to wait out this John, there's no way an unknown is going to beat John F. Kennedy Jr. This matinee idol. Hillary probably would have run, and that would have been a very interesting election, just like the Obama-Hillary election was in 2008. But ultimately, there's no way that John F. Kennedy Jr. would not have become president. He may have become a one-term president. He may have been a horrible president. But there is no way that he would not have become president. He was just too popular. At that time, the Kennedys were still viewed as American royalty. Even if the rest of the family had some questions about them, Teddy Kennedy with Chappaquiddick, so many different, then many of the relatives, there was a rape case with another cousin, there was a tragic skiing accident with another cousin. The Kennedys have had their share, but John F. Kennedy Jr. seemed to have been just ordained. he seemed to be able to rise above some of the disappointments and the bad things that happened to the Kennedys. And yet, it just proved that he even wasn't immune. Which gets to my point about the Hall of Fame. Wow, Jim, how are you still talking about the Hall of Fame? I am, believe me. I'm talking about access. I'm talking about privilege. I'm talking about status. And that's what Hall of Fames are. And I'm not just talking about sports Hall of Fames, as I said before, because every Hall of Fame today it seems to me, has become irrelevant. It has become, it has lost any luster on both sides of the extremities that they have gone. These Hall of Fames have in some cases, based on pure subjectivity, pure like or dislike for somebody personally, not has anything to do with their accomplishments in their field, but it's become personality contest. And to some extent, it's always been, but now, especially with social media, the hypocrisies of the Hall of Fames, how they are run, how they are voted on, who they favor, who they exclude, why they exclude them. I think Hall of Fame, sadly, have lost their meaning. I don't even know if they should exist. In terms of a Hall of Fame term, I think there's nothing wrong with an established institution that celebrates a certain discipline, whether it's in sports or the arts or in the corporate, whatever it is. There's nothing wrong with it. As I said before, you know, there's nothing wrong with giving people accolades and awards for their accomplishments, giving them recognitions, especially for people that have done things that are above and beyond, or that few others have ever been close to accomplishing. I don't see why, accomplishment and a competitive drive are viewed as negative things. But in many circles, in a kumbaya kind of world, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And to me, I think that sucks away your drive and your ambition. And now, if you even have a little ambition, you're viewed as overzealous or whatever, because so many people have been, now we have a whole generation and a half, almost a couple of generations, that have been raised with this idea that, everybody is a superstar. Which then again diminishes the importance of a Hall of Fame. And I'm bringing this up because over the last month or so, there was a voting for the NFL Hall of Fame. And one person, and even two people, were up for voting for the first time, I believe. I don't know about one of them, but I think the coach, Bill Belichick, who came to fame with the New England Patriots, was up to be inducted. Now, this guy, as a head coach, won 6 Super Bowls. And as a defensive coordinator, he won 2. So he is involved in 8 Super Bowls victories, which is unprecedented. Okay, that's amazing. That by any judge of accomplishment in the NFL as a coach, to get to 1 Super Bowl and win it, most likely gets you into the Hall of Fame, because that is such an elusive goal. I mean, think about it. There's been 60 Super Bowls up to this point. There were obviously NFL championships before that, long before that, but the Super Bowl, there's been 60. Just this year was the 60th Super Bowl. So that means that there's only been 30 winners. See how fast I did that division? Half of 60 is 30. Look how fast I did that. I didn't even have to really think. Yeah, I still have my math prowess. I was good in math until we got to algebra 2 trig. I did good in geometry blew my mind. I did good in an algebra at the beginning. But the algebra 2 trig, oh boy. No, geometry. Whoa, that blew my mind. And then algebra 2 trig went off into directions that I was not. I was very good in grammar school and even into high school, but then did that blow my mind. But anyway, but look how fast I just did, half of 60. Boom. Almost didn't even pause there. So there's only been 30 winners. 30 coaches have won a Super Bowl, in theory, and some of them have won multiple. So there's even less. Bill Belichick has won 6 of those 30, six of those 30 winners. He is the 6 of those, which is 1/5 of every coach who's won a Super Bowl. Okay? That's pretty impressive. But Bill Belichick was also kind of a curmudgeon. And Bill Belichick wasn't always open and available accessible to the media during his career. And part of that was, look, hey, I'm here to coach a team and win. And I understand that there's some media obligations, but I'm here to coach and win. No, I can argue with that. But that was his mindset. I think he has every right to conduct himself in that way. I'm sure the team would have loved if he was a little more personable. But you can't argue with his success. He was a very driven, very focused, very committed, and obviously very talented football coach who rose to the top of his profession. At any given time, there's only 32 people who have those jobs in the NFL. Are there 30 teams? Or I don't know if there's 30 or 32 in the NFL. Let me look that up. But my point is, there's not a lot of jobs available. And he had one of them. And he rose to the top. And so it seemed to be a no-brainer that Bill Belichick, yeah, there's 32 teams, I'm sorry. I figured that as much, but I always, I get a little questionable on that. There's, off the top of my head here, I'm not working with notes, so this is all top of the head knowledge here. I know, I've got my script, but but anyway, there's only 32 people that have that head coaching job every year. So it's already a very exclusive club. To have risen to the top of that game 6 times as a head coach and another 2 as a defensive coordinator who's played a major role in those victories, that's as I said, there's coaches that even have never won a Super Bowl. There are coaches who are in the Hall of Fame who have never even been in the Super Bowl as a coach and who are in. So it seemed to be just a no-brainer that, of course, Bill Belichick's in the convention, even though there was this question because, the people that vote on the NFL Hall of Fame are the media members, and so they might be looking to hold a grudge and things like that. And don't get me wrong, Bill Belichick, while an incredibly successful head football coach in the NFL, as I said before, associated with 8 Super Bowls, 6 as a head coach, 2 as a defensive coordinator for other teams. He was also involved in some scandals that involved cheating, and basically it was proven. There was something called Deflategate, anything with a scandal, since Watergate gets a gate at the end of it, about the Patriots at their home field deflating the ball so that it'd be easier for kickers to get a field goal, or setting up some kind of system to steal signs in terms of what plays are being called. Don't get me wrong, Bill Belichick is no angel, and he was found and punished for these infringements. Now, the other side of the coin is that we all know in sports, while there are rules, every competitor finds a way to bend the rules. It's in baseball, it happens all the time. Stealing signs, spitballs, there's bending of the rules in every league. That's the way sports are. That's the way competition is. Once again, the drive to win. Yes, there are rules, and you find the ways to bend them as much as you can without breaking them, and even sometimes if you can't, you break them as well. That's what happens. That's reality. That's the human condition. Deal with it. As I've said many times here, we are far from perfect beings. We are flawed beyond compare in the animal kingdom. So, Bill, Bob, there's a case could be made that, well, you know, he was found that he cheated, but the cheating still cannot in any way blemish the accomplishments. And as I said before, if you want to start looking at anyone who we put up as a role model or an idol, because they are human beings, if we dig deep enough, we will find many flaws. There is nobody who is not flawed. And so when Bill Belichick was not voted in, there was quite a bit of outrage, especially not only in the sports world, but even outside the sports world, to say, well, how could this be? What are the criteria? They were getting down to asking people who vote how they voted. It was getting very contentious. And then the owner of the New England Patriots, Robert Kraft, who has owned the team and has been one of the most successful owners in the history of the NFL. He's owned the team during those six championships. And under the Kraft ownership, they've been one of the best teams the majority of the years. They've been in the playoffs, or they were just in the Super Bowl this year. But they are always playoff teams, or one of the best teams for many years, in addition to winning the six Super Bowls under Robert Kraft. So there are other owners who are in the Football Hall of Fame. So this seemed to be, once again, a no-brainer as well. But the jealousy of either the owners or the media of, well, this guy is so successful, who knows? But, I mean, Robert Kraft and Bill Belichick are going to get in. But there is a prestige that is associated with getting in on your first try, on your first ballot. That really then sets you apart from other inductees to show just how accomplished you were. If you're a first ballot inductee, that shows that even among the elite, you're elite. And clearly, in the media, amongst the ownership, the various ways that these people are voted into the NFL Hall of Fame, there was a big enough contingent of people who were either jealous, who had a vendetta against Belichick, members of the media. He may have treated them poorly. He didn't give them good interviews. He was gruff. He gave them one-word answers, and then they can always point to, well, he was a cheater. Bill Belichick's going to get in, but they didn't want him for what seems to be very personal and very petty reasons. They didn't want to get him in on a first ballot. Now, his stats are not going to change. And yet next year, he's probably going to get in. So then the logical question is, well, then if he could have got in a second year, then why didn't he get in his first year? Because those who voted either had some personal vendetta, some professional vendetta, but some kind of vendetta against him. And they didn't want to give him that elite of the elite status, as well as to Robert Kraft. And to me, as it stands right now, then, one of the greatest coaches of all time, regardless of whatever infringements, we judge the greatest players and the greatest coaches by the accomplishments and the records that they have compiled over a long period of time. And no NFL coach can touch Bill Belichick's record of being associated with 8 Super Bowls. And few owners, if any, can touch Robert Kraft's record of success and Super Bowl appearances and victories. And yet both were kept out on their first ballot. So to me, the NFL Hall of Fame right now is a joke. It's illegitimate. I've heard some people argue, well, you know, these Hall of Fames are really museums. And so what's the difference whether he gets in next year or the first year? Well, you're right on that point. I'll give you that. But we also need to, or should, give Bill Belichick his due. He is one of the elites of the elite. Whether you liked him personally or not, it doesn't matter. He rose to the top of his profession and deserved to be in there. He says, well, he'll get in next year. Hey, what if he has a heart attack in the next year and he doesn't get a chance to experience that? How are you going to feel then? I mean, we've seen many times, I mean, people that have listened to this podcast know that I was a huge fan of the Chicago baseball player Ron Santo, who was one of the best third basemen in baseball, certainly when he played, if not all time. He never played on a championship team or in the playoffs, which hurt his visibility, but he was an all-star every year, golden glover, always, he had the stats and the accomplishments to be in the Hall of Fame, no question. But he wasn't popular with the media who covered him at the time, or a lot of his peers. And so Ron Santo was deliberately kept out of the Hall of Fame while he was alive. There's no other way to say it or to characterize it. He was deliberately left out of the Hall of Fame so that he could never experience being inducted and being introduced as Hall of Famer Ron Santo. There were people that disliked him so much that they did not want to give him that honor. Even though they knew he would get in, which ironically, his stats never changed for 20 years, but the year after he died, he got voted in. What happened? He never played for 20 years. If the stats were there, the stats were there. This was personal, this was a vendetta, and it was hypocrisy in its highest level. That's what happened to Bill Belichick. That's what happened to Robert Kraft. I've said this many times, the Baseball Hall of Fame, and I've been there. I'm a huge baseball fan. It is a museum. It's a very cool, if you're a baseball fan, you have to make a pilgrimage to Cooperstown. I'm so glad I went. But there's also, in my mind, it's also illegitimate. Because the person who has the most hits, and I've talked about this before, in the history of the game, isn't in the Hall of Fame. And, ironically, the person with the most home runs in the history of the game is not in the Hall of Fame. Now, I get it. There's a lot of questions about the cheating aspect. There is a rule against gambling. Pete Rose was found to have gambled while he was a coach. Okay, now, but the hypocrisy of it today is that every major league sport, including baseball, is in bed with legalized gambling or gambling in some way because it wasn't legalized before when Pete Rose was doing it. So that's a huge hypocrisy. Plus, there were Pete Rose was not popular with the media. They're the ones who vote because they're supposedly, you know, they're the experts. They're there every day following these players, following the game. But the people that vote for these Hall of Fames have proven to be very hypocritical, very subjective, and very unfair. And have had personal and have let personal feelings and vendettas get into their voting. Which to me has put all Hall of Fames now up for review. As a museum, that's fine. But then let's not even have this induction anymore. Let's not even have this farce of voting people in when we are not using a standard. It is completely subjective. I have to tell you, I was watching the Olympics. It was very frustrating to watch the Olympics, especially when you watch any sport that uses judges. Any sport that used a judge, I'll use figure skating as the most obvious because it's probably one of the most popular. The judging on the figure skating was all over the board. And a lot of it was biased. And it was based not on the actual performance, but on the crowd reaction or on the popularity and the hype of a certain skater or the dislike of a certain country. As I said before, human beings, we are so flawed. We cannot help. Any sport, what I like about the Olympics is that any sport that deals with a clock or a tape measure, if you're the fastest one, you win. There's no questions about if you lost by a tenth of a second, you lost by a tenth of a second. There's no subjective thing in there. You know, I mean, how many times have you ever seen like the swimmers or the runners, but especially the swimming? When these people, when they're swimming and they just touch the thing and you see somebody just touch it, you know, to win it as somebody's hand is just there and it's a tenth of a second. Well, it's a tenth of a second. The other person got there quicker. They win. They don't say, well, the other person got there a tenth of a second quicker, but the other person had a much better stroke and a much better kick than the other one. So even though the other person got there first, there's going to be some judging involved as well into this. The time counts, but we'll also have some artistic judging to weigh in, and that will determine the winner. No, that's not the way it works. Whoever hits the thing in a horse race, in a speed race, in a skating race, whoever, you know, in a skiing race, whoever gets there first wins. Whoever gets there fastest wins. If you're throwing a javelin or you're throwing a discus or something, whoever throws it farthest wins. It doesn't matter about judging, about subjective judging, artistic value. That's out the window. To me, those are the most legitimate sports. These other sports that are all judged, hey, look, I'm not diminishing the art, the work and the talent of some of these skaters. But if you watched it with any regularity, you saw and you say, well, that seemed like a great skating performance, and then you see the judging, and there was some controversy on the pairs. The French judge apparently voted and gave it to the French judge's voting and judging was so off from everyone else, but the French couple won the gold medal in the pairs or the couples, whatever they call it. And so the United States people were all screaming, not fair, not fair, not fair. But all I know is if you watched the team skate before that, there was a skater from Japan who was perfect, fantastic. And then the hyped skater from the U.S. team, Ilian, actually stumbled. Didn't fall, but stumbled. This other guy didn't stumble. He hit everything perfect. And Ilian beat him. And this poor guy was crushed because he knew he skated a perfect program. But there was so much hype, so much popularity. The crowd's clapping for Ilian as he's going, even after he fell. And the Americans won the gold medal for their team in skating. Oh, I didn't see the Americans complaining about that when it was clear to everyone, even the U.S. team, when they were waiting for the final judging, they knew they were in trouble. So this subjectivity really diminishes things for me. Because it shouldn't be a popularity contest. It shouldn't be who's the hypest or who's the best story, personal story. It should be who wins. Who was the best? If we're going to give a medal, if we're going to go to the trouble of saying this person did the best, then it should be judged that way. It shouldn't be on all these outside elements or something. It's either on the performance or it isn't. Now granted, I don't know how you would do that in skating, for instance. I don't know how you, there's no way to use a stop clock or a tape measure. I get it. But when you watch these sports in the Olympics that have been judged by voting as opposed to being clocked or measured, you always see discrepancies. You always see subjectivity come into the play. And many times you see people winning who didn't deserve to win. And sadly, what you mostly see is you see people lose who didn't deserve to lose. And that's what I'm seeing in these Hall of Fames. Like I said, Barry Bonds, most home runs. Now, there's a big question. During the steroid era in the 90s, the steroid use was against the rules. These players were willingly using them. The statistics were completely inflated, as we see today in a non-steroid world. Nobody's hitting those kind of home runs. I mean, you know, Aaron Judge is coming pretty close. But Barry Bonds in the early 2000s and late 90s, early 2000s, the ball and Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire, these guys were hitting balls farther than anybody hit them and with frequency that no one else had ever hit them. But here's the other side of the coin. Baseball knew it was going on and they didn't police it because it was putting baseball back on the map. The owners knew it. The people who ran baseball knew that these guys were using steroids for many years, but they also saw the ratings. And until it became so obvious that every of these long-standing records were just falling by the wayside, they weren't even records anymore. Well, then finally they said, well, we've got to put a stop to this. But they certainly reaped the benefits of it for a couple of seasons. So if baseball turned an eye to it, why is the Hall of Fame not turning away from it? The game itself allowed it. Look, I'm not for cheating. Don't get me wrong. As I said, I just said before, I don't like subjectivity. But my point is there was so much hypocrisy in baseball on steroids on every side. The players trying to get an advantage and the owners, you know, putting a blind eye to it and reaping the benefits because guys were hitting home runs. Everybody was coming to games and watching TV and records were being broken. So they didn't want to stop the gravy train. But when it comes to the Hall of Fame, then suddenly now everybody's on their high horse. What was happening, nobody stopped it. Hypocrisy. If the game didn't stop it, then the Hall of Fame shouldn't stop it. If the game decides that gambling now is a part of the game, then anybody that was found to be gambling and was banned from the game, they should be absolved and they should be getting to the Hall of Fame with no question. That was the same thing with Pete Rose. People did not want Pete Rose. Pete Rose will get into the Hall of Fame. There's no question about that. You know why? Because he passed away. Because as it stands right now, the Hall of Fame, in my view, Baseball Hall of Fame, as much as I enjoyed visiting it, it's illegitimate. The hardest thing to do in baseball is to get a hit. The guy with the most of them in the history, by far, is Pete Rose. He's not in it. And he didn't take steroids. What he did about gambling had nothing to do with his performance. You can make an argument for Pete Rose over Barry Bonds. Barry Bonds took a performance-enhancing drug to hit those home runs. Pete Rose, there's no question about his records, about his accomplishments on the field. He wasn't even a player anymore. He was a coach. And they still kept him out. They did not want to have him feel what it's like to be a Hall of Famer, even though now baseball is in bed with gambling. Terrible hypocrisy. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Okay, I'm not going to have to. I don't have to stay on hypocrisy. Stay in the sports world for the Football Hall of Fame or the Basketball Hall of Fame or the Baseball Hall of Fame. No, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Every year, they thrive on this now. It was formed in the mid-80s when rock and roll was the dominant music and had been for 20 years. And the people who devised the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame all had a stake in the music business and in rock and roll. It made them zillionaires. Jan Wenner of Rolling Stone magazine, Armit Artigan of Atlantic Records, and many other record moguls. Rock and roll was changed the music business. It went from something that was interesting to ridiculously successful. Look at what we just found. A couple weeks ago, the Eagles' Greatest Hits album from 1971 to 75. It's 50 years old. It just sold 40 million, just sold its 40 millionth copy or whatever in today's world. Who knows what it is? But my point is, rock and roll has been a dominant musical force and cultural force for more than 70 years. And in the 80s, when Jan Wenner and Armit Artigan and others formed the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, rock and roll was at its peak. MTV, this is 85. MTV is dominating. Many of the legends of rock from the 60s and 70s were still in prominence on MTV. Tina Turner, Bruce Springsteen, David Bowie, many of those people, The Who, The Rolling Stones, were all major MTV stars, even though they found their fame in the 60s and 70s. So this was a chance for the upstart rock and roll and the baby boomer generation to put a stamp on rock and roll and make it something that was going to be a part of the American culture forever. So they started the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And it took them many years to raise enough money to build the thing, even though those guys were all multi-billionaires. They didn't want to spend the money on themselves. When they finally opened the doors to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it wasn't in Cleveland, which was a ridiculous location to put it in. Yes, Alan Freed, they opened it up to a lottery, and Cleveland needed some civic pride, and they all voted for it. But it belongs in a big city like New York or L.A., where a lot of tourists go. People don't go to Cleveland all that much. But anyway, when they finally opened up the physical place, after years of inducting people and yet not really having a place to put them in, when it finally opened, The funny part is that, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was established in 1985. And then it was actually opened in 1995. It's like, took them 10 years to build this place. Well, the irony is, by 1995, rock and roll was starting to lose its dominance. It had been the dominant music from let's use Elvis as the starting point, just as the most easy. You know, the mid-50s. So it was 30 years by 1985 when they established it. And then it was 40 years when the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame actually opened. But by 1995, if you go back, you will see that rock and roll was beginning to lose its hold on the music business. Not completely. It has lost it now. There's no question about that. Over the last 20 years, it's lost it. Rock and roll doesn't want to admit it, but it has. But by 1995, when they finally had a place, the rise of hip-hop and of commercial pop, like Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, that was not rock and roll. That was pure pop. That was like bordering on disco, which, of course, we know how rock and disco had such a conflict in the late 70s. So as in now in 2026, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has completely diluted its inductions. Over the last 15 or 20 years, people from the rap world and the hip hop world and the country world have all been inducted. And the heads of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame have tried to justify it by saying, well, these have been rebellious people who broke the rules in the spirit of rock and roll. BS. The fact is that rock and roll has been dead for at least 15 or 20 years. If you look at the Grammys, if you look at radio, if you look at anything, rock and roll does not dominate the charts anymore. Rock and roll is not the dominant music. It is pop music, it is hip hop and rap, and it is country. The rock and roll that we know has been dead for a long time. And some of the legends who are still around are trying to keep it alive, but it's over. There's a whole generation, if not two generations, who have not grown up thinking that rock and roll. There's many people in their 30s and 40s who don't even really respect the Beatles all that much and don't even think the Beatles are all that great. More or less Elvis. Look at the PR campaign to get Elvis back into the limelight. Everybody talked about the Elvis, the king of rock and roll. There's several generations who only know Elvis as kind of a joke. That's why they made the movie, the Elvis movie recently. That's why there's a new Baz Luhrmann documentary about Elvis performing to try to resuscitate his career to show that this guy wasn't just a joke. He was hugely talented. But with all the Elvis impersonators and all the other stuff, there's a couple of generations who don't even know Elvis as anything except an Elvis impersonator and kind of a joke. That's the reality of it. And the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame keeps once again, hypocrisy is ridiculous. They keep clinging to the title Rock and Roll Hall of Fame while they keep diluting their brand by inducting people that are not rock and roll. And especially inducting them over people who certainly are rock and roll. I'm not going to get into the names because the same ones keep coming up all the time. But here's the thing. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, first of all, they like the controversy because it keeps them into the zeitgeist. It keeps people talking. Oh, how come this person's nominated? So they do this on purpose. This is a form of social media marketing to keep the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame viable because no one really goes to visit it all that much, and rock and roll is already a niche music. Okay, there's those who are still out there waving the flag, and I love rock and roll more than just as much as anyone else, but I'm also a realist, and I know the reality of it. Watch the Grammys and tell me that rock and roll is still alive. Give me a break. So the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame can easily get rid of all this quote-unquote controversy, but they want the controversy because it keeps their brand out there, keeps people talking about them. Even if it shows their hypocrisy, they're being mentioned, and they like that because they know that as a musical genre, rock and roll has left the podium in terms of the pop culture world. So anything that keeps people talking about rock and roll with that name, they'll keep it. But we all know that at this point, by putting in people like Dionne Warwick, who is not a rock and roll person, or Dolly Parton, who is not a rock and roll person, or even Cher, she's not rock and roll. She's pop. No doubt about it, one of the greatest pop artists of all time. But she's not rock and roll. She's not Chuck Berry. She's not Jerry Lee Lewis. She's not Elvis. She's not Buddy Holly. She's not Bruce Springsteen. She's not the Beatles. That's rock and roll. Dolly Parton is not rock and roll. Madonna is not rock and roll. Huge pop artist, no question. So all the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame should do and has to do to make it legitimate is to change its name to the Pop Music Hall of Fame. Then that encompasses everything. And there's no more controversy. Then we don't have to complain that Jethro Tull's still not in, or that REO Speedwagon isn't in, but Whitney Houston is. But they don't want to change it for a couple of reasons. A, they want the controversy. And B, to the founders, many of them who are still around, and those who are still clinging to this rock and roll ethos, that it's still the music of the youth, which it isn't by any stretch of the imagination. Yes, there's still crowds out there, but if you go to any kind of concert with a rock band, you'll see that most of them are all gray hair. And the men's bathroom line is longer than the women's bathroom line. I'm not saying anything against it. It's just reality. I go to concerts. I love rock music, but I'm also very aware of its standing now. And in the next 5 years, a lot of the legends of rock are going to be gone. And when they're gone, you're going to see rock and roll diminish even more. Rock and roll is not going to go away. It's not going to become a real niche music like, say, jazz is, or gospel or blues, because rock and roll was more than just a musical genre. You know, the big band era was hugely popular in the 40s and 50s, but it's gone. And every so often there's a revival, but it doesn't last. It's a niche thing. It's a music of the past. Music used to be a form of entertainment, of distraction, that was popular with young people all the time, and with older people too, to some extent. But a lot of times, other generations, they grew out of it. The fact that 80-year-olds and 70-year-olds are still going to concerts to see rock and roll bands shows you how much rock and roll was more than just a genre. Rock and roll was a musical genre, but it also became a cultural influencer and a cultural identifier. It became a flashpoint in history. It encompassed behavior and fashion and political views. It wasn't just a place to go on a weekend to listen to a band. That's what big band used to be. That's what disco used to be. That's not what rock and roll was. With Elvis and then the Beatles, the culture changed. American culture, and then because of the impact that American culture has on the world, global culture changed because of rock and roll. And so the people that founded the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame are those who are still dedicated to the thought of rock and roll, the idea of rock and roll, the spirit of rock and roll. They don't want to give up that term because it is identifying to them. It is culturally significant to them. and they don't want to give it up. Even though they're letting people in who are not rock and roll, they have diluted the standard. They have shown great hypocrisy. They have bent the rules. They have let people in that shouldn't, and they've kept people out that should be in. But that sign, that title, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, for some people who are clinging to it, they don't want to give that up. Here's my prediction. I might not be around to ever see it come true, but maybe this podcast will live on. But I would say in about 20 to 25 years from now, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will change its name to the pop, because rock and roll as a term will not really have any meaning at all. When the generations of today in another 20 years are in their 30s and 40s and 50s, they will want to be celebrating the people and the music that they grew up with. They will want to be celebrating the hip hop and the pop artists of their times. The term rock and roll won't have that same cultural meaning to the people that it still does today. They're still around. But in 15 or 20 years, they're not going to be around. And when they're not around, the people who are in charge at that time are going to go, you know what? We need to change this. And no one's going to, and it'll be changed in a second. There won't even be a controversy because the term won't mean anything. It will still have a historical significance, but the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I guarantee you, will be called the Pop Hall of Fame. Maybe they'll leave that, the Pop and Rock Hall of Fame. But if they were smart, they would just change it to the Popular Music Hall of Fame. It's a catch-all term. Everybody can get in then. Country, hip-hop, rap, whatever. Whatever new musical genre will be invented in the next 20 years. You don't have to worry about these classifications. Rock and roll was a term of its time. It transcended longer than most musical genres in terms of popularity and social significance, but ultimately it's going to fade away. It won't fade away to the extent and become a niche thing, as I said, like jazz or gospel or blues. But as I said, rock and roll, because of its at least 35 or 40 year dominance, 40 might be pushing it, but I'll give you 40, but certainly not 50. By then, hip-hop was and rap was in charge, and pop, the divas and the boy bands and stuff like that. Pop, by the late 90s, early 2000s, had eclipsed rock, and it's only been happening even more and more over the last 25 years. But as I said, when today's generation is more in charge, they won't look at the term rock and roll with such reverence, and they will change the name of that place in 2 seconds. And as it should have been changed 15 years ago. But as we all know, baby boomers and aging rockers, they don't want to ever leave. And so they cling to what, because they feel that they're the most important things that the most important generation ever put on this earth. And so they cling to what they think's important, and while they're still in charge, they'll keep that. But believe me, in about 15 or 20 years, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will be changed. And all this hypocrisy and all this, why shouldn't this person be, that will all be gone. And it will become what it really is, a museum. If these places just would become museums and take Hall of Fame off of them, we also would have no problems, because we should. Hall of Fame connotes accomplishment and competition. Well, we're supposedly in a world where we don't want competition. Everybody gets a trophy. Well, if everybody gets a trophy, then let everybody in. Museums are there to give people what they want. So let's stop the hypocrisy. Let's get rid of this term Hall of Fame. Let's get rid of all this subjectivity and this voting. And just say, this is a museum, and here's a new exhibit, and here's a Bill Belichick exhibit. There's no voting involved. The irony is, if you go to the Baseball Hall of Fame, Pete Rose is there. An exhibit. He's just not on the wall of the Hall of Fame. Okay, well, we're already minimizing the importance of competition, the importance of being awarded something. We've as a society are buying into that. Everybody gets a trophy. So let's stop the hypocrisy. Let's get rid of Hall of Fames. Let's get rid of this subjective vendetta, revengeful vendetta voting. Let's call it what they are. They're museums. If they're museums, then let's have an exhibit. When you go to the Art Institute of Chicago or the Met in New York, they don't have a Hall of Fame. They have an exhibit with Picasso. They have an exhibit with Yoko Ono. They have an exhibit with Cezanne. They have an exhibit with Norman Rockwell, whoever. There's no voting. They have an exhibit. So have exhibits. That's what you have anyway. If you go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, if you go to the Baseball Hall of Fame, it's a museum. Then there's this Hall of Fame little area. But who cares? If we're going to devalue competition, if we're going to devalue awarding people, if we don't want to hurt people's feelings, then let's just be honest about it. Forget the term Hall of Fame. Forget these inductions and these votings. And make these places pure museums. And those who have accomplished will be highlighted. Then we don't have to go through this, there's no doubt that his accomplishments on the field were good, but, you know, he wasn't a nice guy, and he did this and he did that. That's not it. If this is about a Hall of Fame, it means those who accomplished the most in that field, not off the field, on the field. But when you don't let a guy in like Bill Belichick because you don't like him or because he supposedly cheated, and you can say, well, he didn't supposedly cheat. I mean, you know, they lost, they found that they cheated and they lost draft picks. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Are you going to let him in the, Hall of Fame next year? If you let him in the Hall of Fame next year, you should have let him in this year. Ron Santo, oh, you let him in after 25 years and he had to die? Pete Rose had to die? You've devalued yourself. You're going to put Dionne Warwick in before Jethro Tull? You're devaluing your Hall of Fame. So just be honest. Change your name. Call it a museum. Get rid of Hall of Fame and have exhibits and do exhibits on everybody. If everybody gets a trophy, then everybody gets an exhibit. That's what you're leading to. But when this subjectivity plays such an obvious role in Bill Belichick's case, or even in Ron Santo's case, or Pete Rose's case, or in some of these rock bands, then it's ridiculous. If you have a set of criteria about accomplishment, then that's what should count. If you're going to start bringing in personal feelings, then you've delegitimized the whole thing. It's illegitimate. A museum is a place to celebrate people and their accomplishments. We created this idea of a Hall of Fame in a time of competition when we actually valued competition, when we valued honoring people for what they accomplished. But that seems to have been, that's an old thought process now. That's an old ideology. So let's do away with it. Let's not be hypocritical. We don't have to give away Grammy Awards anymore. Why do we just, the awards at a Grammy, tell me who wins the awards. They don't even talk about the winners. They talk about who wore what and who performed together. Who won is like fourth on the list. When they do a report on the Grammy Awards, the winners aren't important anymore. We've devalued it. because we haven't stayed true to the initial founding principles about pure accomplishment. We've allowed personal vendettas, social agendas, and everything else to get involved in who wins these awards now. So they're a joke. As I said before, the Academy Awards used to be the pinnacle. They're a joke. They're going to leave network television in a couple years. Just goes to show you how they've been devalued. But this Bill Belichick thing, it really struck people for the first time in a long time. People could have their arguments about Barry Bonds. They could have their arguments about Pete Rose. They could have their arguments about Jethro Tull. But how do you justify not voting in a coach who has 8 Super Bowl rings? It's purely personal. And here's another question. Okay. This is going to show you even more hypocrisy. Write this one down. Remember where you heard this. So it's pretty much agreed that Tom Brady is the greatest quarterback of all time. He's the GOAT, right? He's the GOAT. Tom Brady is the GOAT. Okay. Tom Brady has 7 Super Bowls. 6 with the Patriots and 1 with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. But Tom Brady was a part of all those cheating schemes. He's a part of all those victories, a part of that whole Bill Belichick era. Brady and Belichick won those Super Bowls together. So Tom Brady, if Bill Belichick is stained from being a first ballot inductee into the Football Hall of Fame because he sort of cheated. But if you're going to use that one, because if you want to deflect the fact that you didn't vote for him because you don't like him personally, or you were jealous of him if you were a coach, or you didn't like him because you're a media member, he didn't talk to you, or he gave you one word answers, or whatever personal reason you didn't like him. If you don't want to give him the status of being the elite of the elite, a first ballot entry into the Football Hall of Fame, that's fine. It's hypocritical. It's stupid. But you can make your argument if you want. Oh, well, he was a cheater. There was Spygate. There was Deflategate. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. But Tom Brady was a part of all of those same things that you are accusing Bill Belichick of. So you better not vote the GOAT in because he's good looking and because he's media friendly. And he's the GOAT. Because if those same criteria kept Bill Belichick out of the Hall of Fame on his first ballot, then they need to keep Tom Brady out for the same reasons that you can't have one sin and one person suffers for it and another one doesn't. Tom Brady won games because of Spygate as quarterback. Tom Brady won games because of Deflategate as the quarterback of those teams. If that was a criteria to keep Bill Belichick out on the first ballot, then it becomes the same criteria to keep Tom Brady out on the first ballot. And I guarantee you that Tom Brady will not be left out. Because Tom Brady is good looking and he's popular and he's media friendly and he's the GOAT and we love him. Bill Belichick was a curmudgeon and a mean guy and we didn't want to give him the honor of being a first ballot. That's BS, that's hypocrisy, that's subjectivity, and it devalues the Hall of Fame. The Football Hall of Fame, the Baseball Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They're all a joke. They're all museums. Let everyone in. Everybody gets a trophy. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And of course, don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 509. I'm Jim Tirano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic from the end of my mind to your ears.